Hello, this is Duncan Steer, and thanks for tuning in to my Radio Days Book Club podcast. This week, I've been reading Sacre Bleu, Zidane to Mbappe, A Football Journey, which is the story of the French football team's World Cup wins of 1998 and 2018, and all the chaos and uncertainty that came in between, both for the team and for the country as a whole. It's a great book. The author, Matt Spiro, is a Londoner who's been living in Paris since 2002, and he's become the go-to face of English-speaking French football. His commentaries appear on BT Sport in the UK. He also presents a Ligue 1 magazine show and are transmitted around the English-speaking world. So Matt's in a great place to take us inside this rich world of stories, some inspiring, like that of Kylian Mbappe, the central figure in the book, some appalling, which are the tales of division, not just in the dressing room, but also in French society in general. This one was done in front of a Zoom audience, invited to attend for free, and so you'll hear some of their questions coming in throughout the podcast. If you want to take part in a future event like this, please follow radiodayservents.com. In the meantime, please enjoy the conversation with Matt Spiro. But I'm very excited to have Matt with me tonight, because he is Mr. French Football. And I'm very interested in France, I'm very interested in football, and the book is called Sacre Bleu, and he's woven together interviews with so many key players in French football, from Arsene Wenger writes the introduction, but Houllier's in there, and Desailly's in there. I mean, I won't name them all. I mean, you probably know, Matt, how many interviewees are there?
I don't know, somewhere between 30 and 40, that includes some journalists, but a lot of coaches, former players, some current players as well. Some coaches in Bondi, where Kylian Mbappe grew up, of course.
And the story is really of what happens between France winning the World Cup in 1998. How did they win it then? And then they win in 2018. But in between, there's an absolutely chaotic period for the team, which is a gift to a journalist. And so, obviously, to get the full thing, you have to read the book, which you can buy on my site or other sites. But we'll try and get a flavour of the chaos. But can we just start, Matt, by, were you always destined to be, because you're the English commentator on the international feed for Ligue 1, were you always destined to be what you are now? Was that your ambition? Did you fall into it? How on earth has this come to pass? You're in Paris, I should say.
I am in Paris. I sort of did fall into it. I was always a massive sports fan, always obsessed with football. For my sins, I was and still am an Arsenal fan, and I'm relieved to see, I think they're getting the job done in Mulder tonight. So I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I came from a family of doctors, and I was kind of, both my brothers became doctors, and I was rubbish at sciences, and I didn't really want to do that. So I started studying economics, and I can say now that it's not that big a surprise that I went into football journalism, because I would all like a lot of kids, I think, you know, I would be writing in my notebook, getting all the stats down, all the scores, and I started writing for the Gooner fanzine. I wrote a few sort of articles for free for them, which I really enjoyed. And then I was studying economics at university, had no kind of desire at all to go into banking, and I could see like the people on my course who were really excited about going earning loads of money, and it just wasn't doing it for me. I do want to earn money, but not necessarily sitting in a bank all day. And I managed to get a job working for a football website. It was in 2000 when the internet boom was sort of just taking off, and I worked for a website called onefootball.com, which was actually a really, really good website, and it gave me a terrific grounding. There were some top journalists who worked there. Jonathan Wilson, probably the most famous of them now, but Marcus Christensen, who's the football editor at The Guardian, was there. Ben Littleton, who's an author and a very good football journalist as well. So I met a lot of people, got good grounding, and I had an interest in French football. I was probably or definitely influenced by Arsene Wenger and the French Revolution going on at Arsenal. I learnt French at university a little bit as well. I had a year, Erasmus year in Paris, and that's how I kind of got to know Paris as well. So I got the chance, in 2002 to move to Eurosport. There was a job going at Eurosport in Paris, and it went from there.
I'm sorry I've made you tell your whole life story. What an open question. But now there's an implication in the book that you kind of refer to, and that is that when France win the World Cup in 1998, it feels a bit like Italia 90 for English football, in that suddenly it's more mainstream and more popular and politicians want to get involved and it's just a bit cooler. But in France, it feels like football has never previously been cool. So I want to know what was the dominant sporting culture, 40, 50 years ago? Was it rugby and cycling? I mean, can you speak a bit to that, about how football kind of belatedly came into its own in France?
Yeah, I think it's probably quite regional, probably more regional in France than it is in the UK, where obviously rugby is huge in the southwest. Cycling, tennis, they obviously love their winter sports as well. So I think it was more kind of spread out in terms of sports enthusiasm. And football was big, but it was not sort of seen as the kind of the acceptable sport to follow. If you were a distinguished businessman or an intellectual, you weren't really allowed to admit that you liked football. So I sort of talk about in the book, it was sort of well known that people going to work, like, they wouldn't want to let anyone see that they've got L'Équipe, in the metro. Everybody would hide it, because L'Équipe, obviously, that's the other thing. People always look at L'Équipe as kind of this, I wouldn't say the equivalent to the Sun, because it's different, but it's kind of seen as this, this newspaper that, is for, you don't really want to be seen with it. And yet it's by far the biggest selling newspaper in France. So actually, everybody reads L'Équipe.
But it's very beautifully, L'Équipe's very beautifully put together. Like, as an English sports journalist, like, I've always looked at it and thought, it's really classy. I suppose this has come after France 98, but it's like, it's not tabloidy, is it? It's nice. Or am I wrong?
No, it's not tabloidy. It's very informative. It's less looking for sensational stories. It's more, much more a kind of complete report, if you like, of everything that's gone on the previous day in the world of sport. And it's they get good interviews, and they're a good, reliable newspaper. It's more kind of that there was this snobbish culture around football, and it was seen as something for the lower classes that you didn't want to necessarily admit to liking or knowing about. And that just completely changed in the 1990s, and in particular, obviously, with the World Cup. It was the moment that it just all exploded.
Well, this is a bit of a side issue, but can you tell us something about the Footix? Now, in England, we have the new football. John Thompson on The Far Show, I don't know if anyone remembers him, talking about going to see Arsenal United and stuff. But you talk about this kind of, there's a lot of these who go and watch France. They're called the Footix, and they're kind of hangers-on. They're not even interested in the game.
No, because football became fashionable. So you've got this sort of generation who were suddenly like, I love football, know all about it. I've been following Liverpool, or I've been following Marseille, whatever, ever since I was younger. And actually they've never heard of anyone other than maybe, like, I don't know, Steven Gerrard and Didier Drogba. They wouldn't have actually heard of the Marseille side that won the Champions League. There's definitely a lot of people started liking football from 98 onwards. And you definitely don't have that same sort of culture of support, where you have loyal supporters who will support their team through thick and thin. Now, you can't really generalize, because there are towns in France like Saint-Étienne, like Lens, who do have this very loyal fan base and have always had it. And it's no coincidence, very working class, coal mining backgrounds. Football's played a massive part in those communities. Likewise, Marseille down in the south. Definitely in Paris, there's so much going on in Paris. Actually, the sporting director of PSG, Leonardo, said a couple of weeks ago in an interview, he was talking about football in general, and he made the terrible comment that Marseille is a football city, and we've had to build the culture in Paris. There's so much else going on, and he's been absolutely hammered for saying that, because as the PSG sporting director, you can't say it. But it's true. So in 98, so the Footix was this was the mascot of the World Cup. He was called Footix, and he was this cockerel, like this giant mascot. And basically, that was the name that then was given to everybody who just suddenly liked football. And I think I mentioned in the book how I started going to the Stade de France to follow the French national team in the early noughties, when they were just unbelievable. They were steamrolling sides. And then as soon as they had a few problems, they had a difficult game, I just remember hearing the Stade de France crowd booing Henri when he missed a chance or booing Trezeguet. And I was sitting there going, what on earth are they doing? And it was significant. Just, I don't want to ramble too much, but I was at the Arsenal played in the Champions League final in Paris in 2006. And Henri missed this chance. He missed a one-on-one to put Arsenal two up against Barcelona. And for the next 5 minutes, the whole sort of Arsenal end, about 40,000 fans, sung his name. And he said after that game, he says, that was when I thought I can't leave Arsenal. And it struck me as it was just so much the opposite of the way a French crowd would have reacted. It had a real impact on him, and he decided to stay off.
Well, I mean, there's plenty about the French crowd. I mean, but I'm going to kind of go through it this way, which will get us maybe to the crowd. Now, I heard you say somewhere that you were going to hang the book on Didier Deschamps at one point because he was the captain in '98 and then the long term and current manager. But that seems quite strange to me because the book is so much about so it's Zidane to Mbappe. Both from, you know, immigrant families. And the book is so much about kind of the racial divisions in France, in the team, you know, how people from certain backgrounds can only aspire to be brilliant at football, and people from certain towns, that's their only outlet. The book is so much about that. Did you kind of change your focus? I mean, when it was going to be about Deschamps, I mean, you must have loved it when Mbappe really came to the fore, and then the whole jigsaw must have fallen into place.
No, I mean, that was quite early days in the thought process. It was sort of after they won the World Cup and I saw the kind of symmetry of Deschamps being the captain in 98 and the manager in 2018. And yeah, that would have been much more of a football-centric book. And I mean, it is, for me, it is a football book, and I don't want to be, I'm not an expert on race and society. I mean, I've tried to talk to some people who are, but I consider myself a football journalist expert, if you like, certainly on French football. So that was kind of the initial thought process. And I think that would have been much more of a football driven book. And the more I thought about it, and obviously race and diversity is such a massive part of French football and French football's success, and such a massive part of French society. Mbappe, for me, once it suddenly, the penny dropped, I was like, hang on, Mbappe's born in 98. And also all of the stories that, we'll talk about, the ups and the downs and the events that have happened in football and in French society, it all kind of fitted in with Kylian Mbappe's life, insofar as, the rioting and the unrest in the Paris suburbs that occurred, in particular in 2005. That was all kind of centered on Bondi. Well, not all of it, but Bondi was one of the hot spots where there was massive trouble. The year that Kylian Mbappe joined the Clairefontaine Academy was the same year that the quota scandal erupted, when Laurent Blanc and the technical director of the FA were heard in this meeting that was recorded discussing the possibility of having a racial quota in terms of when they select 12-year-olds into the national academies. And Mbappe just sort of fitted in with it all. And I thought, well, that's, it's actually very interesting to do the parallel of how Kylian Mbappe was kind of, seeing all of this evolve, and how that sort of helped or has forged his character and his person.
Isn't it? I mean, you see how Glenn Hoddle got sacked for a word out of place. But what Blanc was discussing, there's too many black players in the academy. In France, people are, this is a whole subject here, but in England, the prevailing culture is we shouldn't be racist. There's the kick it out campaign in football. There's a lot of sensitivity around the subject. But reading your book, in France, not so much. It's everything's still a little bit, confrontational, but even the kind of mainstream opinion is a little bit brittle.
The cultures are different. I think there is still a big problem of racism in football and in society in general, whether that's in the UK or in France. I think, but people have a different way of talking about it, definitely in France, insofar as people will talk about blacks and Arabs in their everyday life without kind of thinking, oh, got to be careful what I say here. And there were parts, even in the book, interviews that I did where the publisher said, oh, hang on, you sure, you know, he should be talking like that? That could offend people. So, and I've been true to what people said, all the while trying not to offend people. But there is definitely different language. And I mean, I've interviewed footballers who would talk openly, you know, French footballers who played in England. And I won't name him because we didn't put this interview out. But for him, it wasn't racist. But he said, I found it hard playing in France because the league's full of big black defenders. And it's basically what he was saying was a fact. But of course, they're not only big black defenders. There are some big white defenders and there are some small black defenders. But they don't, you know, I didn't put that out as, you know, as the quote, because I know that it would have made headlines for the wrong reason, saying I didn't like playing in France because they were big black, you know. So yeah, there's a different way of looking at it. The Laurent Blanc comments are shocking. It's important. I do think it's important to take it in the context, and I'm not saying they're acceptable in the context, but it was an argument that was quite complex and that had genuine footballing reasons behind them. But Laurent Blanc and Blackart, the technical director, made these sort of very general comments about how basically what they were alluding to were the fact that, well, look, there are two things. One of them cannot be deemed racist. One is the fact that there are a lot of dual nationality kids who are trained by the federal academies in France and will go on to play for an African country. And that has always sat badly with people in French football. And Gerard Houllier talked very openly to me about it, saying, you know, I don't like it. I don't like the fact that French taxpayers are paying to train a kid who might, when he's 20, go, actually, I quite want to play for Senegal. But it's a very sensitive subject. And I talk in the book about a guy called Ricardo Fati, who came through at Clairefontaine. He was never going to be good enough, I don't think. He played for France at youth level. He was never going to be good enough for the senior team. And then he played for Senegal. And when I interviewed him, I said, oh, I assume you decided to play for Senegal once you realise you're not going to play for France. And he said, oh, no. For me, that was, you know, playing for Senegal. I grew up in, you know, in this African environment at home, and it made my dad so proud. And for me, it was massive. And he was such an articulate, nice guy. And I say this in the book because he told me that he's not necessarily proud of the decision. And he and his dad went back to Clairefontaine to talk to his coaches and to say, listen, we're really sorry. We've decided. So anyway, so the quota system, there were two things. They were saying, listen, we've got too many of these guys basically with African origins who are going on to play for other countries. We don't like that. Okay, you can discuss that how you want. I don't think it's necessarily got a racial connotation.
But some of them are qualified to go and play for, you know, Portugal or something as well, aren't they?
Yeah, there are also, yeah, Rafael Guerrero is a very good player who's basically French and has gone on to play for Portugal. So the other thing is that it was decided that there was a problem, in a footballing problem, in that France were picking too many big, strong guys and that there was too much priority being given to the powerful players. And that was kind of linked to the success of the 98 team and the fact that it was very strong, very athletic, Thuram Desailly, Vieira Petit, big, strong, defensive guys, and that the academies were using that as a blueprint and they were picking the guys at 12, 13 who were the biggest and the strongest. And what Laurent Blanc was saying is that the biggest and the strongest at that age are the black kids. And he's saying, so maybe if we reduce that, we won't let players like Antoine Griezmann slip through the net, because he did slip through the net.
So there is a context. There's a context to it.
There's a context. Had he said, listen, we've got to stop basing it on size, you know, what he shouldn't do is bring the colour into it, unless he's got some incredible empirical evidence about black kids being bigger than their white counterparts at 12, 13. So it was all very loose talk. And the fact that it was recorded, I think, suggests, you know, it was recorded and given, it wasn't released to the press initially, it was given to the guy's superior, and then eventually it got out. But it shows that people were unhappy that there were racist attitudes within the federation.
But I mean, I don't want people to think that I am over-egging this kind of racial politics thing, because it is a thread through the book. And there's one bit, like possibly the most famous low point, is when the players go on strike, and And that, and mainstream politicians, so at one point, the players from the, you know, the underprivileged areas are seen as great, when they win, they're seen as great symbols of French unity. But when it all goes wrong, their behaviour is kind of seen as being, oh, typical kind of, you know, ghetto behaviour. And the country as a whole seems to turn against them. And you use Nicolas Anelka as a kind of symbol of someone who inspires the kids in what I'm using for shorthand, the ghetto. He inspires them, but he alienates the kind of wider France. And it sort of runs through everything. So even that strike is certainly used by the French media and French politicians to, I don't know, is it stoking racial division? I don't know, but it's certainly viewed in a kind of racial way. Is that right, do you think?
Definitely, definitely. But can it be compared to, you know, and this is another, it's a very difficult subject, but we've seen what's happened in the UK with someone like Raheem Sterling, who's had, you know, the press on at him if he's been investing in a house or buying a house for his mum. And, you know, Marcus Rashford has done incredible things, but has apparently, you know, annoyed a few people. It's had a few ambiguous press articles and what have you. And there does seem to be this feeling that successful, wealthy, young black guys in England, perhaps, you know, not everybody likes that. And in France, it was very easy to look at what happened in South Africa in 2010 and to say, poof, what do you expect when you've got Patrice Evra, Nicolas Anelka, Eric Abidal, you know, these guys are badly brought up. These are, you know, and this is not me saying this. This is what somebody like Roselyne Bachelot, who was the sports minister at the time, was sent out by Sarkozy to find out what was going on in South Africa. And she made this speech where it really sounded like she was talking about young tearaways in the ghettos or in the Paris suburbs. And she was using terminology about that you would use usually for violent thugs, drug dealers and what have you. And that, you know, it was definitely interpreted as a racist reaction. And what, you know, what is interesting, I mentioned in the book, the guys who sort of typify this this culture, this sort of yobbish, some people have called it, you know, the scum generation. And again, not my words, but this is what some French philosophers and politicians have been saying. Samir Nasri, Hatem Ben Arfa and Karim Benzema, who were the 87 generation, all born in 87, so talented. And a lot of people have problems with the way they carry themselves, the way they dress, the way they don't seem to be particularly patriotic when they play for France. And what is quite funny, I think, is that very often in these guys, when they get interviewed or in talk shows, people will say, oh, just look at what happened in 2010 with, you know, when you have Benzema and Ben Arfa and Nasri, and none of those three were in the World Cup squad. And so often they get put in that bracket and they like to remind people, oh, by the way, yeah, things were pretty crap when we weren't in the squad, so maybe don't blame it all on us.
But the Benzema story, well, I mean, maybe I should let you choose, you know, what you see as a kind of journalistic, the richness of stories in here. I mean, because we're so familiar in England, you know, I have Five Live on all the time, we read the papers, English football culture is so much turned over and turned over. And I think we're all of us, I mean, there'll probably be a few experts tuning in, but we're all of us kind of dimly aware of French football on the surface, but the richness you find to it with all these interviewees and the way you put it together, you know, there's some interviews you don't use that much, you just use a few little telling quotes, and it's very nicely done. Very Thank sincere you, yeah. praise here. but the Benzema story is just like, so he has associations with sketchy yeah. characters or criminals yeah. basically. And they get hold, and they kind of act as agents for players, and they get hold of a sex tape of his teammate because maybe we shouldn't go into it. People may know it, but that's a gift to a journalist, isn't it? I mean, this is just incredible. It's incredible. Yeah. He's blackmailing his teammate.
Yeah. Well,
and then he complains that he gets dropped.
Blackmailing his teammate directly, but he's helping the black. Well, he's alleged to have helped the blackmailers.
It's still sub judice in France, so you can't say.
I try to be very careful quoting sources from very kind of reliable and established newspapers or radio programs because this is an ongoing case. But yeah, it's unbelievable. I mean, it blew up before, well, I think 2015, so it's before Euro 2016, which was in France, and it was tricky. It was tricky for Deschamps. What do you do when your playmaker is being blackmailed by your centre forward over a sex tape? Because Valbuena, you know, it's hard. Valbuena was actually an important player under Deschamps, was doing really well, and his form just really, really, you know, he didn't handle it. He couldn't keep on playing for France. And he was left out. Benzema was obviously left out, and has been ever since. Yeah, look, there's a very shady world behind a lot of these footballers, and in many ways, Karim Benzema has paid the price for staying loyal to a lot of his friends. He grew up in a very tough suburb in Lyon. The guy he was in. That got him muddled up in the sex tape scandal is a guy who'd been to prison, who had been one of Benzema's closest mates growing up, and he worked a bit for Benzema. So, you know, by all accounts, doing good work, doing nothing untoward. But unfortunately, he was hooked up, yeah, in this gang that managed to get hold of Mathieu Valbuena. Yeah, I mean, they're, like you say, shady characters. There's one guy that Mathieu Valbuena employed for sorting out, whether it's buying a house, buying a car, sorting out his computers and what have you. And he was apparently going through changing one of his telephones or something and stumbled across this video in his telephone and thought, oh, I might keep that. And that's kind of how it all escalated.
That's what you'd do, isn't it? If you wanted someone to fix your phone, you'd definitely get a convicted criminal to get you'd get them involved, wouldn't you?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm not sure he was a convicted criminal, but Benzema's mate. But I'm talking about this. This was somebody else. But yeah, there are various characters involved.
Anyway, it's all very sketchy, listeners, and Matt can't speak with he can't speak freely. He can't speak freely. But perhaps we should sort of this all. I think this all speaks to the football. But perhaps we've got a lot of questions from an ex. Now, I don't know if that's because no one's name is coming up. But there's one about the Clairefontaine Academy. If Giroud reached the summit and Ben Arthur is a bit of a train wreck, is Clairefontaine a waste of time? Now, in the book at the start, I don't know if these questions are all from the same person. Anyway, in the book at the start, the academy is what Houdet sets up. They win the World Cup. England copy it. I think who goes? Is it Howard Wilkinson goes over? So yeah, but then it seems in some way their system, as we're saying, it seems to breed a kind of defensive kind of football. And I thought at one point you're sort of sawing the tree from beneath you because you're the face of French football, and there's definitely a few pages where you're going, it's fairly dull. They don't score many goals, and it's all about defensive midfield players. But so what? Could you speak a bit to that? The kind of the roller coaster history of the academy and how it's kind of regarded. You know?
Clairefontaine was fantastically successful in the first 10, 15 years. They moved, they were basically ahead of the game. They moved in 88. They had the Centre of Excellence in Vichy. It was a very small functional place. And they moved to Clairefontaine and they had this fantastic vision where they wanted this enormous complex. And Clairefontaine is just this very tranquil, beautiful place surrounded by forest. They built a series of stunning football pitches. They have several gyms, saunas. They have all these dormitories for the youth teams. They have the chateau, which is where the senior team sleeps and eats. And no, it's an amazing place. And Gerard Houllier was really important in terms of the football side of things. He was the technical director in 1988, and he's a fascinating guy and much friendlier than I was expecting, because he can be. If you get him on a good day, you're all right. If it's a bad day, he'll give you pretty short shrift. But he was great. He was really pleased that an English guy wanted to come and talk about what he did in back in the late 80s. And he was very proud to say, "Oh, you know, you need to when you develop an academy, you're working for 10 years, and you know, as if by magic, 10 years after I started, we won the World Cup." And he's keen to take credit for it all, even though Thierry Henry was the only Clairefontaine graduate in the 98 team. Yeah, that is right. But what you have to understand is that Clairefontaine, so They have this center of excellence where kids would stay for 3 years, starting at the age of 12. So that was the first time they were getting to the kids at 12. Before, it was like they were joining academies at 15. So now Julio tells me you need to start getting them at 8. Yeah, but anyway, then it was 12. And they would pick the 23 best kids from the Paris region. So I mean, the reservoir is immense. So they got about 700 kids going for trials, and they picked the 23 best in each year. So I think Omri was in the second intake, along with Anelka. William Gallas soon followed. So obviously lots of good footballers. They all made it basically in professional football. They didn't all have careers like Omri, but they also then developed 13 regional Clairefontaine equivalents, where they'd have, again, 23 intakes each year. But it wasn't just about these 23 kids in all the academies. It was about Clairefontaine instilling a culture in youth development. All the clubs had to follow the methods. They all had to hire at least one federation youth coach. And that's what Robert Pires was saying to me. He didn't go to Clairefontaine, but what he learned at Reims and then at Metz, he says it was identical to what Omri would have learned at Clairefontaine. So it was very much, it wasn't just you had to be at Clairefontaine to succeed. It was a kind of national or nationwide revolution. So if Omri maybe, you know, was the only one, but Vieira, Petit and these guys, they had this education that meant that they were so good technically and so good on, you know, so good on the ball. And France, they had this ability to be strong and technical at the same time. And it was phenomenal in 98. And it may be too simplistic to say this, but probably the turning point was, so Aimé Jacquet was the coach who won the World Cup. As a reward, he was basically told that he could become the new technical director of the FA, which was, I think he took as kind of an honorary role, where actually it's a really, really important role where you've got to really work hard. And, you know, Houllier said it in a very polite way, my friend Aimé, he politely said didn't do very much. The L'Équipe head journalist, Vincent Deloup, said that it was the worst period in French football, the most damaging period in French football. Jacquet was technical director from 98 to 2007, and it just stagnated. They stuck with the methods. And the feeling was, yeah, that they had this very kind of defensive physical system that worked. And while Germany kind of took the Clairefontaine methods and added, I don't know that what would Germany have added, maybe a bit more speed. Spain, it was all about intelligence. So that they were all kind of, you know, picking the bones from Clairefontaine, and Clairefontaine sat still and got left behind. And and Julia had to go back, and he did go back and started rebuilding. And that was when they decided we've got to follow the Spanish model, and we need to start getting these smaller, intelligent players. And we're not just talking about, you know, we're not talking about an IQ, we're talking about footballing intelligence, obviously. Players who can read the game. Because Clairefontaine, the trademark of Clairefontaine was this like repetitive drills. The players were basically had it drilled into them that they do these different exercises. They'd have a ball coming across from one side, they'd have to control it with one foot, turn, pass it that way, and then do it 30 times in 5 minutes, whatever. And then they do another exercise. So it was like they didn't learn to think for themselves. Which was okay if you had Zidane in the middle, he'd do all the thinking.
Was this a book that a French journalist could have written? I mean, you sort of said there, Houllier liked that you were an Englishman who was interested. Do you think people were more open to you for that reason? And who could you say who is your kind of your go-to interviewee who's just kind of very welcoming, and who couldn't you get?
It definitely helps being English, yeah. I mean, sometimes it doesn't help. And Houllier did say at the end, he said to me, how long have you been in France? I said, since 2002. And he said, did you work for The Sun? Or I think he said The Sun. And I said, no. And he said, okay, so it wasn't you who followed me when I was at Liverpool and had all the... I don't know. There was some story. I do know that Houllier does hold grudges. And anyway, there was some story that an English guy had been feeding The Sun from France, and he was just curious as to whether it was me.
Was it you?
But I talk. No.
So it was a double bluff.
No, no. But I made money once. I'm giving away all these secrets. I made good money once selling a story to the Mirror. When it was back in the day when if something was in L'Équipe, it wouldn't be like on Twitter 10 minutes later. Now it's on Twitter 10 minutes later. But I sold a story to the Mirror where Houllier was coming to the end of Liverpool. It was the time when Lawrenson, Hansen, all these guys were like in the media slagging him off. And just in one, an interview he gave to L'Équipe, and at some point he said he's fed up of all these connards, former players talking. And connard translates as assholes, and the Mirror just put this big assholes on the front, on their back page. And anyway, but don't tell Gerard that. So yeah, look, it can help. I talk in the book about how I interviewed Raymond Domenech a few times when he was France manager, and how he was so different with me. And I'm, you know, it's not because I was special. I think it's just because I was English and the French press. There was just this war between Domenech and the French press. And when I interviewed him for the Irish Times, for the Times in London as well, and it was like he was just happy to be talking football and not having to, you know, worry about being tricked by a French journalist, because that happened quite a lot. So, but Dom, and he said he'd interview, he'd meet me for an interview for the book. And, you know, what is hard is pinning these guys down, because some they'll say yes, and he said yes, and then he just didn't reply, and then kept, you know, all the phone calls. And so it's a shame I didn't get Raymond Domenech, and I used quite a bit from it. His book is amazing, actually, the account of the World Cup in South Africa. It's an amazing book. So I quote that a bit. Thierry Henry I didn't get. I mean, to be honest, Henry and Vieira, I've quoted Henry a few times, but from secondary sources. Henry and Vieira were disappointing misses for me, sadly. So, yeah. I was hoping, because I interviewed David Dean, and I was hoping he'd be able to help me, what with his son being Thierry's agent. And he did help me. But Thierry was just, it was at the time he was being sacked by Monaco. He was out of work and he didn't want to do it. It was a great shame because he, you know, his story is fantastic. And I made it clear, I mean, you know, Henri, it should be said, will not really talk about the French national team. I mean, that's another subject entirely. But he's been very kind of hurt by everything that happened. The way the country didn't support him over the handball against Ireland, the way he just feels he was always underappreciated in France, really, despite being the leading goal scorer and a phenomenal player. But I did pitch it as I really want to talk about, you know, the role of the Paris suburbs and how it forged you as a person and Claire Fontaine, obviously. But sadly, it wasn't for the, maybe for the update.
There's quite a lot. I mean, the book is seemingly full of players who've fallen out with, refused to play, being banned from playing for the French team. It's like, whereas in England, I can only think of Chris Sutton. So I don't know what that. I don't know what that says.
It's interesting though, because nothing gets out in England. And then, you know what? In France, what I like over here, that it harms a lot of the teams, is that so much gets out, and the players, they all know, they're all mates with journalists. And I think it was probably like that in England in the 80s and 90s. And then the clubs have just policed. They've become so, you know, in the Premier League, so strict about everything. The players are super careful. But no, these French journalists, the top journalists, they all have ins. You know, they all have people who will talk to them exactly about what. I'm amazed, you know, after a PSG defeat, not the next day, the day after, you'll have a blow-by-blow account of what happened in the dressing room afterwards. And you'd be like, okay.
But it's, I mean, you obviously don't name someone, but there are obviously players who are very hard for journalists to deal with. I mean, there's one player who swears at a journalist in a mix zone, which I think that's Nasri. I mean, that's on the record, isn't it? But
yeah. I was standing next to the journalist that he I had a front row view.
Yes, it comes out. It's very eyewitness. But have you had bad experiences with some of these players? I mean, you've been covering it so long, because I suppose in England there's players who don't talk, who won't give interviews, but some of this, it seems like they will, but they'll be rude to you, or there's I mean, have you ever felt this is going very badly as a journalist, this is an awful man? Have you ever had that feeling? Not now, obviously.
No, I don't think so. I mean, overwhelmingly, I'm really happy. I mean, yeah, I'm trying to think of somebody who has been really horrible. I mean, no, not really, not
But they're
really.
quite, they're quite,
No.
their behaviour. I mean, obviously, as we've said, English players get criticised for their kind of bling, which just means, especially the black players maybe, with the kind of racist connotations of that. But that generation of French players were seen to be quite spoiled.
Yeah, well, I mean I think that can relate to the academy system as well, and the fact that in France, the economy of the clubs relies a hell of a lot on players' values and players' sales. So if a player is hugely talented, like Hatem Ben Arfa, I use it as the example in the book because he was seen as the next Maradona, to be topical, rest in peace. At the age of 17, he was seen as being, already worth 10, 20 million, and by the age of 19, he'll be worth 50 million. So he was a tearaway and a good guy by all accounts, a lovely, lovely chap, but just didn't listen and did what he wanted, and nobody could bring him into line because the club couldn't discipline a guy or couldn't, unsettle a guy who could feasibly leave, before he signed his first professional deal, or so the kids are kind of, treated like kings already when they're 15, 16. And I think that, yeah, that leads to this culture. And I mean, why it's different in France to in England, I mean, probably the fact that the players there are 16-year-olds who are kind of worth more than than the football club is worth. You look at like Eduardo Camavinga, he's worth more than Rennes are worth today.
Because it's a selling league, because so they have to hold on to them till they can sell them to one of the big leagues elsewhere.
They can't afford to unsettle these players or to push them out. Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons. But otherwise, I think it's difficult to generalize. I think it's difficult to generalize. People who know Karim Benzema say he's a very, very nice, very simple, straightforward lad. Nicolas Anelka as well. I mean, I spoke to his biographer. I interviewed for the book and close friend of his. And he's just the opposite of what you'd expect. And I remember as an Arsenal fan being really frustrated because he looked a bit lazy, a bit disinterested at times. He was brilliant when he turned it on. But it's just the way these guys are. It's different. It's different. They're not like Roy Keane and Graeme Souness and whatever. It's a different type of footballer these days.
Take a couple of questions off the Q&A. Send in some questions because we should let Matt go soon. We don't want him to read out the whole book. It's meant to be a taster. Now, I think these may be from different people. Hi, Matt. Has Mbappe been learning Spanish from an early age because he's been dreaming of playing for Real Madrid for so long?
Yes, basically, yes. I think I don't know what age he started exactly, but he did have that trial at Real Madrid, or when he was 12, yeah, I think 12 or 13. And he most definitely from a really young age has had this career plan, and he talked to relatives, talked to his uncle, I think when he was 10 or 11, already saying, yeah, I'm gonna go to Clairefontaine, I'm gonna then win the league in France, then I'll go to Real Madrid and win the Champions League. Oh, and I'll win the World Cup. And he's just had it in him that he wants to do this, and he's gonna do everything he can to do it. In some respects, that's a bit kind of Cristiano Ronaldo-esque, but he's not like Ronaldo in that he's not a crazy trainer. Like he doesn't go crazy in training. He's quite a laid back sort of guy, but he makes sure he does. Yeah, he does everything that he needs to get his way, and there is every chance he'll go to Real Madrid and win the Champions League.
I should say one of the themes in the book is that Mbappe, although he comes from Bondi, which is just beyond the end of the metro and is one of these places where the riots were, I mean, I'll just say in passing that when he's presented as a rags to riches tale, that's not the case. His parents are quite middle class and kind of community leaders. And so that kind of throws a further confusion into this whole, discussion.
Yeah, no, that would be very easy, wouldn't it, to say that, he's this guy who's hungry, he's come from nothing, and That was my initial thing because I thought Bondi, yeah, okay, a lot of kids there have very tough upbringing. But no, his parents were like unbelievably supportive.
He has piano
Just
lessons, doesn't he? Or does he have violin
he
lessons?
flutes. No, he played flute, swimming and tennis
Yeah, flute
lessons,
in the
and
ghetto. Don't get you far there, does
because,
it?
well, yeah, but they have a conservatoire, and yeah, he I don't think he particularly liked it. I was there in Bondi when he was went back after the World Cup to celebrate with Les Bondinois, and there was about 10,000 people. And the mayor of Bondi gave him this flute as a present. And you could see he kind of felt, like when you've got a teenager and your mum kind of presents you with, and it really felt like he was kind of embarrassed, like, oh, please don't ask me to play this
Ask
or
me to
whatever.
play Marseillaise. Well,
But yeah, and he was getting in trouble. He was getting in trouble at his school, and they put him in a private school when he was 11. So they had money to pay for his education, and yeah, it was a massive, massive. I mean, his parents were huge. Obviously, his mum was incredibly present, and his dad was his football coach as well as his dad. So.
well, it's shades of when Newcastle had a trumpet playing playmaker. Write in if you can name that player. Go on, write in. So we've got Cantona was supposedly offered a last gasp chance to join the 98 World Cup squad if he agreed to play as an out and out striker, but he declined. Would they still have won with Cantona, considering Givash's performance?
Yes. I mean, you never know. Maybe they would have imploded and he would have headbutted somebody. But no, I think Zidane and Cantona could have been a partnership, I think. But Cantona wanted to be the number 10. Didn't want to play as the centre forward. So it's a shame. It's a shame. Whether it was Eric saying, I'm not playing centre forward, or whether it was Xhaka saying, not sure, I want to kind of have this maverick in the squad, something might go wrong. Not totally clear.
I'm a massive Karembo fan. He's not the most technical of players, but how is he regarded in France?
Quite low profile, actually. Yeah, spent quite a lot of his career abroad. He's been in Greece. I think he's in. Does he still have a role at Olympiacos? But he played a lot in Spain with Real Madrid. But yeah, super footballer. Super footballer. His wife was more famous than him as well, which doesn't help. But yeah, really good player who honestly doesn't get talked about very much. I think when you're part of a generation, I always think with Robert Pirès, who I'm lucky enough to know quite well, he's such a phenomenal player, but he's always just been kind of like the guy in the background, behind Zidane or behind Bergkamp, or whereas he's somebody who actually deserves a lot more recognition than he probably got.
Yeah. We've got Michael McNally from Phoenix, Arizona. He's a fan from Phoenix, Arizona. Will he be working on another book to explore even more of French football history? Look forward to reading the book. Thank you both for your time today. This is wonderful. Write in some more of
Oh,
those
that's
sort
very
of
nice.
messages, people. Come on.
Very nice. Yeah, I'm not at the moment. I'm not working on another book at the moment. I'm really, yeah, don't know, really busy with what I'm doing at beIN Sports, which is not just the commentary of Ligue 1, but we do all the programs on the French league. So the Ligue 1 show, like the weekly magazine show, and we do lots of interviews, lots of shooting and stuff for that. So I'm busy, but I did enjoy it. I wasn't sure I was capable of writing a book. I've always enjoyed writing, but it's not been my kind of. I don't feel like I'm a natural passionate. I've always felt. I don't know. Do you know who Jonathan Wilson is? Because he, if you, if it, yeah. So he's written like 30 books, and he's, and I, yeah, and I, and this guy, he's a machine. And I used to go. We used to do like. I used to go on the Africa Cup of Nations, and we'd work together, and the World Cup and stuff. And I'd be doing my report for the Irish Times, and he'd be doing like seven running reports for like seven different papers at the same time. And I'd just be like, oh my God, like, how does he do it? But look, there's a lot to write about in French football. So yes, I enjoyed the experience. So another book might be coming, but not quite just yet. Apart from the update of Sacré Bleu, although you definitely need to buy it now.
Yeah, buy it
There might be an
immediately.
update next year.
But I mean, Matt's being very hesitant and humble, but it is really well put together. And I mean, partly because there's so many great stories to tell, but he's jigsawed it all together and very, very, very. I'm going to say entertaining, engagingly. Alex Bacon, I know Alex Bacon, of course I do. With his Bacon 25 Zola shirt. What is Michel Platini's current standing in France?
Better than it is outside of France. No, look, he's with Zidane and Raymond Kopa. He's France's greatest player. He's the guy who inspired them to their first win in 84 at the European Championships. And I think people were proud that a Frenchman was the president of UEFA and had considerable influence in football. I think France is always a bit paranoid or has a bit of a complex that, they don't have the clout they should have. So Platini represented them, and he's not called a money-grabbing cheat as much in France as people outside of France might say. So no, he's still revered. He's still revered in France, definitely.
And how far away are France from having a black or ethnic minority manager? Are they closer than England?
Ooh.
That's the whole question
Yeah.
hanging over the book, isn't it?
They're not close. They're not close. I mean, I don't know. I mean, there is a chapter in the book where I talk about, the fact that there are very few ethnic minority managers in France.
Well,
And,
you do say, I actually wrote this quote down longhand, where you say, Ligue 1 is packed full of French Harry Redknapps and Sam Allardyces, old
it
school
really is.
coaches who are seen as experienced and reliable and move from one club to the other. And then you list about 20 of these guys who presumably
Well,
run the
some of
whole
them,
league.
yeah. Some of them are not in work, Elie Boop and people like that. But you've got, yeah, Christian Gourcuff, Michel Desakarian. There are lots of them. So somebody's saying Kombouaré. I do like Kombouaré, but he's never going to be the France manager, Antoine Kombouaré. I think the question somebody asked, would PSG have won the league had they not sacked Kombouaré in 2012? That's possible. They were top of the league. This was in the first year with the Qataris. And they sacked Kombouaré, who is a former PSG great. Yeah, I mean, in the 90s, he was a terrific defender for them. And they were top of the league. They appointed Ancelotti, and they ended up losing the title to Montpellier. But anyway, I'd say I mean, probably the closest, because he's the only one I can think of, is Patrick Vieira. But he's got his critics in Nice at the moment. I like Vieira. He's not his team is not producing probably the sort of football it should be, because they have invested quite a lot of money in the last few months. But I think he's a really, obviously he's got charisma, aura, but I love his sort of calmness. And I think he's a good manager, but he's a long way off being appointed France manager.
Is there a manager out of the Redknapps and Allardyces that we don't know who is a big character in France, maybe regarded like a Harry Redknapp, that we don't know that maybe you could flag up for us?
I was going to say Roland Corbis. He's somebody you need to read up on. He's done a bit of prison, Roland Corbis. Lovely guy. He's had a lot of clubs, and but he is a guy who, yeah, I mean, I'd have him higher up than Harry Redknapp, because he's a good football man, and he's a real motivator. And to be fair, he's managed bigger clubs than Harry Redknapp, because he's managed the likes of Marseille. Yeah, there's a famous match in the late 90s where Marseille were 4-0 down at home at the Velodrome against Montpellier, and all the fans left. And I don't know what he said exactly, but he had this unbelievable team talk, Roland Courbis. They won 5-4. And sort of from the 70th minute onwards, when it was like 4-2, the fans all started coming back. It was hilarious. And they had Pires and Dugarry, and Laurent Blanc scored the winner from a penalty. So yeah, Roland Courbis. But the guy, he's not really in the same category, but he's a really good manager, Christophe Galtier, who's done a really good job at Saint-Étienne for 8 years, I think, and is at Lille now, has been at Lille for, it's his third season. And I think they can compete for the title with PSG this year. Galtier, I like him a lot.
We should close now. If you've got one more question from the floor, please send it in now, because I'm going to ask one more question. And that is, at the end, you're quite hopeful, as though there's all this chaos and sketchiness and dressing room rows. At the end, because of course they win the World Cup, Mbappe comes through. He's well spoken. He can unite everyone with his genius. Deschamps is a highly disciplined manager who's apparently got everyone pulling in the same direction. But you do also kind of hint that at any moment it could all fall apart again. So what is your can you clarify your conclusion in this book? Is it
I think, look, it's not just because they won the World Cup in 2018, everything's great. Like the upturn started really with Deschamps, a difficult first year, but then when they turned it around against Ukraine to qualify for the World Cup, there has been a steady kind of upward curve. And just the amount of talent is unbelievable at the moment. I think as long as Deschamps is there to kind of channel that talent and not let egos get, 'cause I mean that is what he can do that other coaches can't. He, you know, I've seen the way he's talked to Mbappe and the way that he's treated Mbappe. Now, if Thomas Tuchel tried to talk like that to Mbappe, he'd be off. People listen to Deschamps in France, and he already had the track record as a player and even as a club manager, but you know, he's won the World Cup now, and yeah, he can keep these people in line. So my conclusion is I'm really excited. I think France have got a great chance. But this is what the French, you know, are like, though. They're just criticizing the team all the time. They've won the World Cup, and the football, they feel that Deschamps, and he is pragmatic, and it's not necessarily free-flowing, and there is a constant kind of line in the press, social media, why is Benzema not playing? Why are they not playing more attacking players? It's so defensive, it's so boring. But, you know, as an Englishman, I'm like, I'd take these results, you know. I think he's doing okay. But what was interesting, Vincent Deluc, who I respect a lot, the chief football writer for L'Équipe, he said to me, talking about Mbappe and talking about going forward, he said, look, what we've got to see now. He said to me that that Mbappe is not especially popular in the France team, that he's, you know, he's very much a brand, he's his own man, he's, you know, whereas somebody like Paul Pogba, who is also a bit of a brand, but, you know, he's very much a team man, Pogba, and really helped to bring that team together. And Deluc said, what concerns me, or what I'd be worried about, is the fact that we've got like the Pogba generation, which Pogba, Varane, Griezmann were the leaders in 2016. And Mbappe is now the superstar, and he could be, you know, taking a little bit of power or too much attention away. And although Pogba may be a team man, Griezmann and Varane as well, they have egos as well. So could, you know, so what was interesting, you know, just this guy has been following France since the 70s or 80s, and he knows about dressing room problems, and he was kind of like thinking, not sure the unity is going to last that long. But yeah, the quality is there, and if Deschamps, you know, keeps going, I think they can win more tournaments.
Thanks again for listening. I think Matt was a great guest, and I think having the Zoom audience in the room really added something as well. So I'll be trying that again with some future recordings. Keep in touch at my website, radiodayservents.com, which has got news of some upcoming events from theatres as well. Also the Facebook page, Radio Days Events, or the Twitter at The Third Umpire. Matt confirmed at the end that Paris and France, like the UK, is still on lockdown. People are going to work, but most shops and all hospitality places are closed. So I hope we can keep bringing some diversions that can pass the long, strange hours at this time. Drop me a line at radiodayservents@gmail.com if you've got any suggestions or feedback, or just if you're bored. Thanks again for listening. See you soon.